Welcome to Herb W. Morgan's Weekly Economic and Market Commentary, a podcast about markets, investing, politics, and profit. Each Monday, in less than 20 minutes, Wall Street portfolio manager Herb W. Morgan distills all the complex and complicated into the simple and sensical. Here's Herb.
Good morning, everybody. It's Monday, March 18th, 2024. I'm Herb Morgan, Senior Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer here at Cantor Fitzgerald Managed ETF Portfolios. This is my weekly economic and market commentary. As a reminder, you can follow me intra-week on LinkedIn, just Herb Morgan, or on X, it's at ETF_strategist. Presentation you're about to see and or hear, for those that are listening audio only, is designed for use with both financial advisors and investors. Of course, each are expected to make their own investment decisions. Nothing contained in the presentation should be treated as investment advice. There are no recommendations for the purchase or sale of any securities. The information contained herein is for informational purposes only. Well, with that out of the way, we had a red week last week. That's okay. You know, it's kind of healthy considering how far we've run, really in the last, let's call it almost 18 months, just a straight up market. And I'll get into some of the reasons why I think we paused a little bit. But we've got a big week ahead of us, and it's Monday morning at 8:30 Pacific time, and the markets are up, you know, pretty big at the moment, really wiping out last week's losses. We do have small cap stocks, domestic, down about 2% on the year. That's diverging from large and mid. And as you know, our positioning has been to be overweight large cap, overweight US on the equity side, a little bit short on the duration side for fixed income, which helps when interest rates are going up like they did last week. We're also overweight technology through our weighting in the QQQ ETF. And then we've got a little tactical or opportunistic position on play with China. And that's actually starting to make a little bit of a move for us. Let's get into some of the data that we saw last week. Let's start with small business owners. Small business owners really aren't feeling particularly good. The index for the month of February fell from 89.9 down to 89.4. That's six declines in 7 months. You can see there's one up month right there. Getting near cycle lows, we've got to go back, you know, really almost 10 years to get to a level this low on optimism. On the one hand, we think, well, that's sort of a negative thing. We want small businesses to be optimistic. But remember, we're also in a process of fighting inflation. So having less optimism means less investment, means less CapEx, means less hiring, potentially, and it would be considered on the margin disinflationary. So while we got CPI and PPI last week that were not particularly favorable to the Fed's liking, it's data like this that lets them believe that they're still on track, that the inflationary pressure is coming down. If you're the small business owner, you don't particularly like this. But remember, the Fed's job is maintaining price stability. Moving on to the aforementioned CPI and PPI, the consumer price index for February gained 0.4% after a 0.3% gain in January. The year-over-year number on headline CPI is 3.2. The Fed's target, the self-imposed target, this is not a statutory target, but a self-imposed target of 2% core PCE inflation. Core backs out food and energy. There's a good reason to do that. Core CPI, which is not PCE, but similar. Core CPI gained 0.4%, and the year-over-year is 3.8. So there's no metric to suggest the Fed has met its statutory objective of price stability and then its self-imposed definition of price stability at 2%. They're simply not there. But they're looking through this data, looking at other data, similar to what I just showed you, to sort of come to the conclusion that it might be there. The Fed is meeting this week, Tuesday and Wednesday. There's virtually no chance, in my opinion, that they will cut rates. But what I do expect from the speech afterwards and the press conference afterwards is that they'll begin to tell us when they think they might start cutting rates. And they're going to phrase this as, hey, we don't see the economy slipping into recession. We're not going to cut rates for that. But what we are doing, they're going to say that they've been in restrictive territory the chairman will use the term restrictive territory. We've been there for some time, and it is appropriate to dial back that. Now, there's two schools of thought. A lot of folks think we're not in restrictive territory. We're in where we should be for fighting inflation, for taking the inflationary forces out of the economy. The PPI, or Producer Price Index, gave similar results. PPI up 0.6%, but only 1.6 year over year. That's helpful. Core PPI up 3%, 0.3%, and is up 2% year over year. That is at the Fed target. Of course, we're all consumers, right? Okay, moving on. Initial weekly claims for unemployment, or weekly initial claims for unemployment, down to 209. This has been, as you can see, low, coming out of COVID, staying low, still far more job openings than there are unemployed people in the country. That is inflationary, not disinflationary, and it is certainly suggestive that we are nowhere near entering into a recession. We got retail sales for the month of February. Those were up 0.6%. Take out autos and gas, because gas is such a highly volatile commodity product. They're up 0.3%. And so retail sales are holding up just fine. Where we still see pockets of weakness is in manufacturing. Recall, the U.S. economy is roughly 85% services and about 15% manufacturing. That's very different than it was in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, even into the 80s and 90s. But we have evolved. Our economy has evolved. And the New York State Manufacturing Survey just obviously covers New York State, but a very important state, really dove last month, -20.9. New orders significantly down, -17. Shipments down. Even employment went down, and the outlook remained pretty low. This is a data point that the Fed, as ahead of their meeting this week, looks at and says, hey, this might be a leading indicator that inflation will drop further. Therefore, it is okay to signal to the markets that we're done raising, which they've already done, and that the first cut may be near. The idea they want to do is skate through this and not have a recession that results from the rate increases. Now, keep in mind, you say, well, that's never happened. Well, it's true it's never happened, but we also never had a supply-side recession. Remember, the recession that resulted from the policy of COVID was a forced shutdown of a very vibrant economy. It was a strong, growing, robust, inflation-free economy that we voluntarily shut down. And then we voluntarily reopened with massive amounts of stimulus. This is something we've never done before. We've never had a supply-side recession. So here we are. Industrial production and capacity utilization, this is another indicator the Fed will see and say, hey, we are making progress on inflation, and we will get to the 2% core PCE. Why will they say that? Capacity utilization, which is the red line in the right-hand scale, right? Yes, right-hand scale here, traditionally correlates with inflation as it's going up, meaning we're using more and more of the capacity of our factories. Therefore, pricing, things goes higher. That is considered inflationary. When you get above 80, we economists and market strategists, we usually look at this and say, we're going to get some inflationary pressure. As it's coming down, which you see that it is here, and we are down to 78.3%, that is a signal of disinflationary pressure, which could ultimately work its way into the CPI and the core PCE figures. We got Michigan, University of Michigan's consumer sentiment number last week. Fell from 76.9 to 76.5. This is all similar to that small business, those small business numbers. They've been trending down for several years, mostly because of inflationary issues. Energy pricing is a good example of that. A couple of little higher readings in the last few months as some of the inflationary pressure has gone off. Household net worth is strong and going up. And matter of fact, I threw in a couple of great slides for this week. He said, well, Herb, you know, if the Fed's going to cut rates, the economy is strong, and there's not any unemployment, we're not heading for a recession. All true. Corporate profits were great last quarter. We're getting ready to come to the end of this quarter. They should be great again. Why aren't you going further overweight equity? Why aren't you buying more equity in the portfolio? Well, then you get to valuation, right? So this green line represents the risk-free yield. as defined, I define risk-free as the yield of the 10-year U.S. Treasury. If you buy a 10-year Treasury bond today, 4.33%, no risk, full faith and credit, a guarantee of the United States of America. If you buy the S&P 500, which we do, we buy both of these things, right? You get the earnings yield, and the earnings yield is below the risk-free yield. Now, if you open up your investment textbooks tell you that stocks are risky. That yield, that earnings stream is not guaranteed. Therefore, you should get paid an ERP, an equity risk premium, and it should be above the yield on the 10-year treasury. So when this happens, where the risk-free yield exceeds the earnings yield, it's one way to say the stock market is somewhat overvalued. But making an absolute statement like that can get you in trouble. Well, why? Well, number one, the bond market could come in and rally strongly, and that 4.33 yield could drop to 3.5 pretty quickly, right? Without stocks going down at all. It's always relative. Everything's relative. What else could happen? Well, we could get into earnings season, which is going to be in about 3 weeks, right, into April, and the earnings for the S&P 500 could come in high, better than expected. There's a risk that that earnings yield is suddenly higher based on today's prices. So using any indicator as an absolute without context can be foolish. All that being said, on the margin, stocks are fairly fully, if not a little bit, overvalued when you have a risk-free yield of about 4.33%. And if inflation's coming in at 3 or 2, you're getting a real return without risk owning U.S. Treasuries. That was fun. So what gives me concern right now, besides a little bit high on valuations? Well, I'm always concerned about debt and deficit. Debt can take down an economy. It took down the economy in 08. It was household debt, mortgage debt of households. That's oversimplification. But this chart here is the Fed's balance sheet. Now, the Fed, remember, to stimulate the economy and drive interest rates to zero during the COVID shutdowns, went out and purchased treasury bonds and mortgage bonds in the open market. And by doing so, they took their balance sheet from sub $5 trillion prior to COVID to the peak, you can see here, of about $9 trillion. And we call that printing money. So the Fed was printing money. They printed $4 trillion worth of money and put it into the economy in many different ways. And then on the fiscal side, we did the same thing. The U.S. Treasury did that. The U.S. government did that. And it massively stimulated the economy, and it caused the inflation we're now trying to fight. So how do you fight that inflation? Well, you reverse the things you did to cause it. But we don't want to have a shock to the system, to the economy. We don't want to cause a recession. So they've been taking it out slowly. This is the balance sheet today. So we've gone from almost $9 trillion to $7.5 trillion. That's $1.5 trillion of money shredded, literally deprinted $1.5 trillion. That is definitely disinflationary, and that is definitely one of the things the Fed looks at and knows very well. It's their balance sheet that they know is having ultimately going to have the impact they want, which is to be disinflationary. But still, you have $2.5 trillion more circulating than you did prior to COVID. So it's not like it's deflationary. It's somewhat disinflationary. And $7.5 trillion is a smaller percentage of the economy than, say, it was a couple of years ago. This is a graph of the U.S. GDP in nominal dollars, not real, right? So our economy is now roughly $28 trillion. And you can see the trough from the COVID-related shutdown, we were at about $20 trillion. 20 to 28, that's a 40% growth in the economy. It's a staggering number. So if the balance sheet were to have grown less than 40%, the ratio to the total economy would not be ultimately as problematic as we like to sometimes think. The next graph I wanted to show you is to take that balance sheet that I just showed you, the Fed's balance sheet, the $7.5 trillion that's down from $9 trillion, and divide it by the current GDP dollar that I just showed you. We're looking at a $28 trillion economy. And so how much is that balance sheet as a percentage of GDP? And when it got high, it was pretty dangerous. And it's still high, but it's coming down. And markets move more on the directionality of things than they do on the absolute level of things, right? So yes, the absolute level is still high, but the good news is it's come from 37% of GDP to 28% of GDP, and it's expected to continue to decline further in the coming years as the balance sheet continues to roll off. Okay, very good. We move on. Now, what do we see here? This is the one thing that still gives me a lot of concern. Public debt, that's the total outstanding debt of the U.S. Treasury, including the $7.5 trillion that is essentially just owned by the Federal Reserve, which is, can be problematic in some economic theories and textbooks, of course, divided by that current GDP. We don't ever expect that the U.S. will be debt-free. Right? We're a perpetual life entity, right? All of us were born, the country was already old. We will pass away and the country will continue to operate. That's at least theoretically the case. And so having debt is not the end of the world. It's a question of how much debt you have relative to your GDP. And this is the area where I have the most concern for our portfolios, is at some point there is a level of outstanding debt, knowing that we must pay interest on that debt. And that interest will come at the expense of other things we'd like to spend money on, like education, like housing, like infrastructure, like helping the poor, like all of those things. But you've got to pay your debt first. You got to pay your interest on your debt first. And so now, let's go back here to the turn of the century. Public debt in the United States, the percentage of GDP, was, let's call it 50 to 60% of our output. Now we're at 120% of our output. We were at 133 or 134% at the height of COVID. These are levels that most economic texts would say are at levels of high risk. Now, the U.S. is unique. We are the world's reserve currency, and we can do a whole episode on why we're the world's reserve currency. It's because we won World War II, and having that ability allows us to do deficit spend with less of an implication than it would be for lesser nations, let's say, or other nations would be more appropriate. So all that being said, this is still something that's out there. It gives me worry. But that growth of the GDP that I have showed you over and over is still very solid. Okay, in terms of data, we already got the NAHB housing market sentiment indicator out this morning, and it was past that 48. I think it was 51. I'll have to double check that. Don't hold me to that. And that is the line of delineation between contraction and expansion. So at 51, that was a big surprise. The other thing that's happening this morning, the reason the markets are rallying so strong, is it appears that Google may be the default artificial intelligence or AI search engine on your iPhone. Replace the Hey Siri, it will give you a far more robust answer. Potentially going forward. Tuesday, we've got housing starts and building permits. The Bank of Japan meeting, I don't usually tell you about the Bank of Japan, but there's a lot of speculation. It didn't get into the consensus that they will change their policy rate. You know, our policy rate is 5.25% to 5.5%. Theirs is minus 10 basis points. They've been fighting deflation there for a couple of decades, and they have a target on their 10-year treasury of zero. And there's a lot of speculation that this week may finally be the end of that. So that may have some implications for the market on Tuesday. Obviously, the biggest thing is Wednesday, our FOMC. They're not going to change that rate, that target rate from 5.25% to 5.5%, but they will most likely give us a better indication about how long we're going to stay at 5.25% to 5.5%. Will we have June, et cetera? When will be a potential rate hike? There's an interesting IPO on Wednesday, a company called Reddit. Two companies that have that are good indicators of the directionality of the economy, FedEx and Nike, both report on Wednesday. That'll be important. Then we've got jobs claims, Philly Fed. So we wonder if that'll be bad, like the New York or Empire was. We've got S&P Global's U.S. manufacturing PMI for March. That's a flash reading, as is the services reading. Both above 50, shows an expanding economy, existing home sales, and then really nothing scheduled on Friday. Don't forget, available as a podcast, audio only on all the different formats, also now on the YouTube channel. The name of this presentation or show or whatever you want to call it is Slaying Bulls and Bears. We'd like to make the complex and complicated as simple and sensical as possible. Please give us a thumbs up and a like, tell a friend, and all that good stuff.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to download the slides for this week's podcast, please visit www.efficient-portfolios.com, where you can subscribe to the weekly commentary podcast in all the usual ways. And if you wouldn't mind, please rate us in iTunes and tell a friend.